President Favetti, the recording is now on. It is 2:02 p.m.
Hey, thank you and welcome. I'm using my gavel to call to order this regular meeting of the Civil Service Commission, Monday, August 18th, 2024. Our commission will read a statement with more information about our meeting today, and thereafter staff will tell us how we are handling public comment.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Civil Service Commission meeting this Monday, August 18th, 2025. This meeting is being held in hybrid format with the meeting occurring in person in City Hall Room 400 and available to view on WebEx if you have an item scheduled on the agenda. The public may listen to the meeting by calling 415-655-0001 and using access code 2663-921-0057. We welcome the public's participation during public comment periods. There will be an opportunity for general public comment on items not on the agenda at the beginning of the meeting, and there will be an opportunity to comment on each discussion or action item on the agenda. Each comment is limited to 3 minutes. Public comment will be taken both in person and remotely by video or call-in. For each item, the commission will take public comment first from the people attending the meeting in person and then from people attending the meeting remotely. Commission staff will provide further instructions on how to provide public comment via phone or video. If you need assistance accessing the meeting virtually or by phone, please call 628-652-1100. Please note that city policies, along with federal, state, and local law, prohibit discriminatory or harassing conduct against city employees and others during public meetings and will not be tolerated. Moreover, public comment is permitted only on matters within the jurisdiction of this meeting body. Commission staff will now provide further instructions on making public comment remotely.
As stated on our agenda and our website, this meeting is being held in person and remotely. For members of the public attending remotely who wish to make public comment, the phone number is 415-655-0001. The meeting access code is 2663-921-0057. Please make sure that you are in a quiet location and that you turn off any television or radio to reduce background noise so the commission can hear you. At the appropriate time, the president will ask the phone lines to be open for any public comment. If you wish to comment on the particular item, you will be prompted to press star 3. This will add you to the speaker queue. The auto prompt will say the callers are entering question and answer time. You will be queued in the order in which you press star 3. There will be an automated voice that will tell you when it is your turn to speak. You will have 3 minutes. When your microphone has been unmuted, you will hear the meeting facilitator ask you to state and spell your name for the record and to make your comments. Commission staff will begin your 3 minutes when you start speaking. When your time is up, you will be asked to finish your comments and the meeting facilitator will place you back on mute.
Thank you. Executive Director Ng, could you please call the first item?
Item number one, call to order and roll call. President Favetti.
Here.
Vice President Minor. Commissioner Leung has been delayed. Commissioner Wood.
Here.
And we have a quorum.
We go to the next item.
Item two, request to speak on any matter within the jurisdiction of the Civil Service Commission, but not appearing on today's agenda.
This is the opportunity to speak to the Civil Service Commission on any matter within our jurisdiction, but not appearing on today's agenda. Comments and general public comments should be directed to matters solely under the commission's jurisdiction. If you have public comment and you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, we do have one caller on the line.
Okay, I guess we should go ahead and unmute the caller.
Commissioners, if I could please read my portion before public comment.
Correct.
During general public comment, members of the public sometimes wish to address the Civil Service Commission regarding matters that may come before the commission in its capacity as an adjudicative body. The commission does not restrict this use of general public comment. To protect the due process rights of parties, however, the commission will not consider statements made during general public comment in connection with the appeals before it. If members of the public have information that they believe to be relevant to a matter that will come before the commission, they may wish to address the commission during the public comment portion of that agenda item. The commission will not consider public comment in connection with a matter it must decide without providing the parties an opportunity to respond. At this time, the commission will take public comment on matters not on the agenda, but within the jurisdiction of the commission. The maximum time allowed will be 3 minutes unless a significant number of speakers request to be heard, in which event the commission president may elect to reduce the maximum time allowed. A subsequent comment made by an individual speaker after their initial allowance is limited to 1 minute.
Caller, if you could, or could we unmute the caller, please?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Caller, please state and spell your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Thornton, C-H-E-R-Y-L, last name Thornton, T-H-O-R-N-T-O-N. What I'm bringing here to the commission today is an issue between supervisors and line staff. Currently, I would like to bring to your attention that currently supervisors are represented in the same bargaining unit as the staff that they supervise. And what has happened is that this has created somewhat of a challenge and a hostile work environment, because we are in the same union and bargaining agreement, that oftentimes staff is coming after supervisors for actually doing their job or trying to adhere to the policies of the city and county of San Francisco. And when supervisors do that, they're accused of harassment, discrimination, and other things. And so then next thing you know, they're under investigation. Sometimes some of these supervisors are investigated multiple times, yet to find no evidence. But it's very it's very overwhelming. And so in this case, because we're represented in the same bargaining agreement, oftentimes our union representative does not agree with what's going on with the supervisors, and the supervisors are really being put in a very difficult situation with their union. So I know that you guys can't answer any questions today. I'm sure that you have nothing to do with where different jobs are assigned to which union, but I would like to bring it to your attention, because many of these cases that are coming forward in EEO or grievances through labor, if you really dig in, you'll see that there's a conflict between supervisors and line staff. So I just want to bring that to your attention, because we need help. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. O'Donnell, are there any other callers?
President Favetti, no further public comment at this time.
Okay, shall we go on to the next item?
Item number 3, approval of minutes, special meeting of August 11, 2025. Recommendation, adopt the minutes.
Commissioners, do you have any modifications, edits,
nope.
Changes, a motion?
No changes. I move we adopt the minutes of our special meeting of August 11, 2025.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, is there any public comment on the motion? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press *3 now. And that's on the approval of the minutes for the special meeting of the Civil Service Commission on the 11th of August, 2025.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, I'll do a roll call vote. Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye. The vote is unanimous, 3-0, to approve the minutes of August 11th, the special meeting of the commission. Shall we go on to the next item?
Item four, announcements, announcements of changes to the agenda. Commissioners, item 16, appeal by Brian DeNave of the Human Resources Director's determination of insufficient evidence to sustain a violation of city policies requiring reasonable accommodations for qualified disabled employees is postponed to the meeting of September 16th.
Okay. We also have on the announcements agenda if there is any intent to sever an item from the ratification agenda. So I'll poll the commissioners. Vice President Minor.
No, I'll wait to hear from SEIU.
Commissioner Wood.
Yeah, I wanted to sever DPH PSC ending 5426. And DPH PSC ending 5440.
Is there any public comment or a member of the public who wishes to request the severance of an item from the ratification agenda? If you're in the room, come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
Hi, commissioners. This is Nate O'Green, SEIU Collective Bargaining Coordinator, supporting severing DPH 5440 from the agenda. It's not the right time. It addresses something, issue that the Board of Supervisors actually voted 5 years ago to preserve in city employment, and that legislation hasn't been amended. And so it's a empty exercise to approve the PSC until the Board of Supervisors takes action.
We'll be calling that item separately. Okay. Is there any other member of the public in the room who wishes to come to the podium to sever an item on the ratification agenda? That's item number 7 on the agenda. In the room, come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, so it's very reasonable to the remainder of the ratification agenda has not been severed. We have not had a member of the public or the commissioners, unless otherwise occurring while the item is called, the remainder of the ratification agenda, except for contracts ending with the Department of Public Health, ending in 5426 and 5440, will be severed. The remainder of the ratification agenda is likely to be approved. Now for the consent agenda. Commissioners, Vice President Minor, do you have an item that you wish to sever on the consent agenda?
I would like to pull item number 10.
Commissioner Wood.
No.
I would like to also, I have one small question on item number 8, which is, item number 8 is the annual report on certification of eligibles, entry and promotion, uniform ranks of fire, police, and sheriff. And item number 10 is a report of future employment restrictions and probationary releases for the period of July 1, 2024 to June 30, 2025. So those two items will be severed from the consent agenda unless there is a member of the public who wishes to sever another item on the agenda. If you're in the consent agenda, if you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, so it's reasonable to assume that the remainder of the consent agenda, except for those two items, item number 8 and number 10, will be approved upon calling the consent agenda. So shall we go on to the next item?
Item number 5, Human Resources Director's Report.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Congratulations to Dr. Eisen, too.
Yes, yes. She is away visiting her grandchild. So thank you for having me. I have no items to report today.
Okay, then I don't think we need any public comment on items that there is no if there is no report, correct? Or no. Maybe I'll ask for the department. Go ahead and ask for public comment on the report. Of no report from the Human Resources Director. If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
Okay.
Yeah.
President Favetti?
Yes.
No public comment at this time.
Okay, shall we go on to the next item? Executive Director's Report.
Item 6, Executive Officer's Report. Commissioners, we apologize for the delay for our year-end report. That will be at the September meeting. I also want
to inform you that we are actually expanding our training. There have now been requests for departments for training regarding personal service contracts. What is it that the commission reviews? Why is there a review? So we are working not only with the contract divisions of the department, we are also including the HR staff that are involved with contracts to bring the two groups together. So we have to say that there may be a future request for a position just on training alone, just because of the amount of requests. These trainings are done, conducted in person. We've also had former departments who asked for training of their hiring managers if we would do this on an annual basis for their department. So the signs are good that people want the information and the information is helping.
Thank you very much. Is there any public comment on the Executive Director Civil Service Commission's report? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, and there's not an action either, so shall we go on to the next item?
We are now on the ratification agenda. All matters on the ratification agenda are considered by the Civil Service Commission to be non-contested and will be acted upon by a single vote of the Commission. There will be no separate discussion on these items unless a request is made, in which event the matter shall be removed from the ratification agenda and considered as a separate item. Item 7, review of requests for approval of proposed personal services contracts. And recommendation of the Human Resources Director, adopt the report, approve the request for proposed personal service contracts, notify the Office of the Controller and the Office of Contract Administration.
Okay, we are on the ratification agenda and we have two items that have been requested for severance, and that is both with the Department of Public Health, with the contract number ending in the last four digits 5426 and 5440. Are there any further to be removed? Shall we go ahead and shall we take an action for the remaining contracts on the ratification agenda?
Shall I make the motion?
Yeah.
I move that we adopt the report and approve the request for proposed personal services contract on the ratification agenda, agenda item number 7, except the two pulled contracts, 5426 and 4440, both with the Department of Public Health.
Second.
Yep. Okay. Do we have any public comment on the motion to approve the ratification agenda, except for the two items that have been severed, 5440 and 5426, both with the Department of Public Health? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
I can't do the roll call vote. Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye. The vote is 3-0. The remaining items on the ratification agenda, except for 5426 Public Health and 5440 Public Health, have been approved. Thank you very much for coming online. Thank you so much for the time that you spent online. Thank you. So shall we go first to Department of Public Health 5426, and if a representative from the department could come forward, and Commissioner Wood, it's your call. Yeah, I did have one question too.
Good afternoon, President Favetti and commissioners. My name is Milan Dowin, and I'm the manager of contractual pre-award at the Department of Public Health. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to present on PSC ending in 5426, Crisis Stabilization Unit and Hospital Diversion Program. This is a new PSC for continuing services. DPH is pleased to report that we have received a waiver from SEIU. DPH is reducing the PSC amount from $25 million over 60 months to $20 million over 48 months, and that we will meet with SEIU in 4 years to discuss the feasibility of bringing some of the work in-house. Additionally, we have received a waiver from the Union of American Physicians and Dentists. Joining me today is Jay Avila, Assistant Director of Youth and Family. We have prepared a presentation and we'd be happy to walk you through it. We are also here to answer any questions that you may have.
Yeah, Commissioner, Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I appreciate getting the presentations in advance of this meeting. That was very helpful. My only question was had there been any further communication with the Union of Physicians and Dentists post July 22nd, which was the last notification in the communication we had, but it sounds like there has been and they've provided a waiver.
Yes, that's correct. We met with them and we explained the services to them and they provided us a waiver.
That was actually my only concern.
That was my only concern too.
Yeah.
So perfect. Okay. So do we wish to hear the presentation or are we okay? So should we make a motion?
Yeah. I make a motion to approve PSC from DPH ending 5426.
Second.
Any public comment on the motion to approve contract number ending 5426 from the Department of Public Health? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press *3 now.
Executive Director.
Commissioners, with the motion, will you please also announce the change in the amount and the duration? And then it will allow us to be able to go into the system to make the change.
Oh, okay. So shall we put that as part of the motion?
Yeah.
So we might as well restate the motion.
I'll restate the motion to approve PSC ending 5426 with the amended duration and amount of 20 million, 48 months.
Second. I second.
Okay. So we are now at public comment on 5426. If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press *3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, I'll do the roll call. Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye. It's 3-0 on 5426 to approve with the amendments of amount on $20 million and 48 months. Shall we go on to the next item, which is contract number 5440, Department of Public Health.
Good afternoon, President Favetti and Commissioners. My name again is Milan Dowen, and I'm the Manager of Contractual Pre-Award at DPH. I'm here to present on PSC ending in 5440, Residential Services for Adults and Older Adults with Serious and Persistent Mental Health and or Other Behavioral Health Needs. While this is a new PSC, the model of providing residential services in a community setting has been in place since at least 1991. DPH had a meeting with SEIU on July 8th and a second one on August 12th, 2025. We're happy to report that Local 21 did not object to this PSC. Joining me today is Kelly Kirkpatrick, Director of Administration and Operations. We have prepared a presentation and we'd be happy to walk you through it. We're also here to answer any questions that you may have about this item.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. As Milan said, my name is Kelly Kirkpatrick. I'm the Director of New Beds and Facilities for SFDPH at our Behavioral Health Services Division. Thank you for hearing this item today. I want to begin by recognizing the dedication of our city staff at the Behavioral Health Center at Zuckerberg San Francisco General, who for decades have provided compassionate care to some of San Francisco's most vulnerable residents. As Milan shared, we have met twice with SEIU related to this PSC request. We have had additional meetings to discuss the related project at the Behavioral Health Center at ZSFG and with union partners as well. The item before you is an expansion of an existing contract, not a new one. It reflects our responsibility to ensure that residents at the Behavioral Health Center at ZSFG continue to receive the most appropriate care in the right type of setting. And it directly supports Mayor Lurie's initiative to expand behavioral health treatment resources for people experiencing homelessness with complex behavioral health needs. It's important to emphasize that this change does not reduce civil service workforce. No jobs are being eliminated. Over the past 7 years, SFDPH has added more than 755 new permanent civil service FTEs, reduced our vacancy rate from 14% to 2%, and created 37 new RN positions just this year. At the BHC specifically, we will be adding 20 to 30 new PCS positions as part of our proposed redesign. All current BHC staff will continue in city positions. This redesign also supports providing professional development opportunities for staff to grow into higher licensed and clinical roles that reflect the needs of a locked subacute care setting. This is a proven model. SFDPH has partnered with community providers for over 30 years to deliver adult residential facility, or ARF, and residential care for the elderly, or RCFE, services. About 80% of San Francisco's residential care beds, ARFs and RCFEs, have already been operated by licensed community providers. This proposal simply aligns the remaining 20% with that long-standing model. Residential care is and has always been a community-based service. DPH's role is to operate hospitals and acute care settings, while community partners run licensed residential care and long-term living facilities. At the same time, San Francisco desperately needs, and what the BHC was always designed for, is locked subacute capacity. This is a rare asset in San Francisco. It is one of the only few facilities in San Francisco that can be licensed for a locked subacute unit. And thanks to state grant funding, we're now able to modernize and expand that level of care. Adding these beds will relieve pressure on acute hospitals, provide the right level of care for patients who cannot safely be placed in open residential settings, and strengthen the continuum that relies on community-based providers for residential care. At the heart of this proposal is our commitment to our residents. Some individuals at the BHC at ZSFG have lived there for decades. We are designing this transition with dignity, stability, and continuity of care as our guiding principles. We are working closely with residents, families, staff, and providers to ensure that their needs are met throughout this process. This is not about reducing services. It is about expanding capacity, modernizing care, and aligning our system with best practices. By creating the right balance between city-run acute and locked subacute services and community-based residential supports, we can meet the needs of both current residents and those still waiting for placement. Slide, please, Pamela. The Behavioral Health Center is a valued part of our system, and it was always designed as a hospital-based locked facility. It was never intended to be a residential care program. For the past 30 years, San Francisco's ARF and RCFE residential beds have been run by licensed community providers. And as I said earlier, 80% of SFDPH's ARF and RCFE residential placements for people with behavioral health needs are run by licensed community providers. This proposal simply aligns the remaining 20% with that longstanding model. Again, at the same time, we face a critical shortage of locked subacute step-down beds. These are the same beds that the BHC was built to provide. And with new state grant funding, we'll be able to double the amount of in-county capacity for this bed that is in high demand. Without this necessary expansion, patients will remain in acute hospitals for longer than necessary, tying up beds and leaving others waiting in crisis. This is why realigning the BHC with its original purpose for psychiatric treatment is both clinically appropriate and urgently needed. This transition strengthens our continuum, preserving and expanding community-based residential care while modernizing the BHC to focus on its original purpose. It directly advances Mayor Lurie's initiative to expand behavioral health capacity across San Francisco and help tackle the homelessness crisis. Slide. This expansion is necessary to fill a gap in our system that is proven by our data analysis of bed needs. Right now, we are missing this middle level of care, both residential subacute services that allow people to move safely out of hospitals and into community-based care. Without this step, too many residents remain in acute beds where they no longer need that level of care, and others who need acute admission are left waiting. The Hayes Valley facilities provide a solution. Those residential care facilities will expand our residential care capacity add specialized subacute memory care supports and support and create additional flow through our system. Importantly, it is not a reduction of our workforce at the BHC. We are actually adding 20 to 30 PCS positions. It is an expansion of our continuum of care. Next slide, thank you. The two Hayes Valley facilities allow us to expand licensed residential care into our continuum of services. DPH's role is to operate hospitals and acute programs while our community partners run residential long-term care. That model has always been the foundation of our system, and the Hayes Valley programs build on that. By expanding capacity through Hayes Valley, we ensure that current residents at the BHC and ZSFG have continuity of care, while also creating new access for people still waiting for placement. This is a resident-centered step forward, one that gives our residents the right to care in the right setting. It also opens beds for people who are currently waiting in psychiatric emergency rooms or acute hospitals for placement, or people who are conserved and potentially homeless, ensuring that they receive access to treatment, not time on the streets, in jail, or in endless ER stays. This is not a change of care. It's a return to the BHC's intended role as a psychiatric treatment facility while expanding the continuum with specialized boarding care elsewhere. Next slide. Our workforce is the foundation of our system. We recognize that. I want to be clear. No civil service jobs are being eliminated by this contract. In fact, we've expanded our civil service workforce by more than 750 FTE in the last 7 years, reduced vacancy rates to historic lows, and added 37 new RN positions this year alone. At the Behavioral Health Center at ZSFG, even after adjustments to certain classifications, the redesign nets 20 to 30 new positions overall, strengthening workforce and expanding capacity for locked subacute care. We will continue to meet and confer in good faith with our labor partners to ensure that any staff reassignments are handled fairly, transparently, and with full respect for our employees. Importantly, this redesign does not reduce services. It modernizes the workforce to meet higher acuity requirements, aligns staff developments with the original purpose of the facility. This ensures that staff are supported through training and professional development while residents benefit from stronger clinically prepared care teams. Our residents are at the heart of this proposal, and we know that some have lived at the BHC for decades. We know that change on this scale is difficult. We hear that. We deeply understand that. And that's why we take seriously the responsibility to protect their dignity and continuity of care. This transition is being designed around BHC resident needs with input from their families, staff, and providers every step of the way. We've already met with over 40 clients on the second floor of the BHC to understand what their needs are. The Hayes Valley sites will bring specialized supports such as memory care that the BHC does not currently provide, thus allowing aging in place for clients who need that level of care as they age. This isn't about moving people for the sake of change. It's about ensuring that they live in a setting that's tailored to their needs while maintaining stability, community, and continuity through the process. The Hayes Valley facilities at 601 and 624 Laguna are licensed residential care homes and will be operated by experienced community providers. These facilities bring specialized supports into our system and allow us to expand capacity citywide to address critical behavioral health needs for more vulnerable clients. I want to emphasize these facilities do not replace our BHC staff or services, they add to them. This is about building a continuum, not subtracting from it. And in closing, commissioners, this is an expansion of an existing contract that strengthens our behavioral health system. It expands the continuum of care, protects every civil service position while adding new ones, and provides dignity, stability, and continuity for residents who have trusted us with their care. It also responds to one of San Francisco's most pressing needs, the shortage of locked, subacute, and residential placements for people with behavioral health needs. By expanding through Hayes Valley, we align our system with best practice. DPH continues to operate hospitals and acute care while our community partners provide residential supports. This balanced approach ensures that every San Franciscan, whether they need acute care, subacute services, or long-term residential support has access to the right care in the right setting. This redesign, again, nets 20 to 30 new positions while expanding capacity, modernizing care, and aligning with best practices. With that, I'm done with my presentation. I'm joined by my colleagues from SFDPH, including Luena Kim, the Director of Human Resources for SFDPH, Angelica Almeida, the Chief Integrative Officer at ZSFG, who helps manage the Behavioral Health Center, and Yoon-Jung Kim, the Director of our Residential System of Care at the Behavioral Health Services Division of SFDPH. We respectfully ask for your support today, and we are here to answer any questions that you have.
I think I'd, well, Commissioner Wood pulled this, and I'd like to hear from.
But actually, I have one question.
Okay.
At least one, but I'll go into this one first. You had mentioned staff reassignments. Would you expand on that? What are you anticipating?
Yes, there are, so the LOC subacute treatment care requires higher levels of care, and there are some differing levels of services required, including group services. And so there are a certain classification of jobs at the BHC that we would potentially reassign to other vacancies within DPH. We have vacancies in our LPTs and LVNs and other roles. I'm happy to turn to any of my partners should they want to expand any more.
It'll be a higher level of care. Is that what you're talking about? Are they being, and I don't mean by replaced, but they're going to be staffed by what level of care compared to what it is now? So the staff that you're going to have to reassign, what is the difference in the levels? Is it?
I'll turn it over to Luena or Angelica.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Luena Kim, Head of HR for DPH. Thank you for that question. So we currently have about 116 FTEs. I hope I'm going to answer your question. If not, please just ping me and say that didn't answer the question. Yeah. I'm happy to try. So we currently have 116 FTEs in the Behavioral Health Center. We will need 141. Mm-hmm. Of those, we think that approximately we will have 50 new positions added, but because we are all going to So if you think of the first, second, and third floor of the BHC, the third floor is the locked subacute. I know, Commissioner Favetti, you're really familiar with the BHC.
Well, yeah, but involved as hiring for when it opened.
Exactly. Yeah. So the third floor has the highest subacute level, so that is a staffing level we would need to go to, converting the first and second floors also to locked subacute.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a number of staff in the first and second floors currently with who may or may not have that same skill mix. We have, even though we've done a great job in filling our vacancies, we still have about currently 890 vacancies within our department. We have an attrition, given our size, of approximately 40 to 50 FTEs a month attrit out through natural attrition. This is a transition that will happen over the course of the next year or two, so we have a little bit of time to work on this transition. Individuals who would like to stay at the BHC, which we hope they do, we will help work with professional development opportunities. SCIU has a wonderful education program. We will work with them to do that. If individuals feel that they would like to work in other parts of our department, we have a lot of vacancies and a lot of need to help support that. I think that those who will, we have a number of behavioral health team leaders who are licensed LPTs, licensed psych techs, or LVNs. We have a number of opportunities for them throughout our department, or we'll help them within transition within the new BHC. I hope that answers your question.
That's exactly what I was looking for.
Thank you very much.
We go on, and let's thank you very much, and thank you to the department. Let's hear from the employee organization, from SEIU. Is it? I'm assuming is SEIU. Yes.
And if SEIU could also please assist us in spelling out your last name.
NATO Green, green like the color. NATO like the military organization. Collective bargaining coordinator of SEIU 10-1. I'm here with some of our staff and members. We object to this PSC. The union made a, this include, it is a new proposal. It includes some existing, the maintenance of its funding for some existing private board and care. The union made a counter proposal that the part of it that deals with relocating the behavioral health center be separated, and the city could move forward with the PSC that deals with the maintaining funding for the existing private providers. The city rejected that proposal. We have a lot of problems with it. This is the main problem with what Ms. Kirkpatrick said is that it was all misinformation. Except for that, it was fine. That is to say, obviously we support accessing state funding to rehabilitate the existing facility. Obviously we support the expansion of services. There is nothing about the relocation that requires the privatization of the existing service. So even though in the building that remains, there is going to be a different service than what the workers there are doing now for a different patient population that might result in new FTEs, there is no way around the fact that they are calling the redesign to get around the fact that what it is elimination of an existing service, or it's a privatization of existing service. There is something that has been done successfully for decades by public workers, and the only rationale presented about why that function should be privatized in a new location is that it also happens to be operated by private providers elsewhere in the city. But that's true of the whole public health system. There are public and private SNFs, there are public and private hospitals, there are public and private clinics. That our whole health system is a mix of public and private providers. And if the only justification you have for why an existing successful publicly run service should be privatized is that there are also private providers in the name of some kind of balance, that's a major shift and escalation on the city's erosion of public work and public service. And to be clear, as we did have a couple of meetings with them about it, and what we got as confirmation is, as of yet, there is no staffing plan for the Laguna Honda sites. So we've had only general terms about what types of positions and what the FTE mix and what the skill mix is. They have no way, there's no coherent dashboard or way of evaluating patient outcomes across the system of these residential facilities. What we know about the existing BHC is that from the staff is that a lot of the patients that are there are at this higher level of care. It's not just like any other community-based institution. They're at the BHC because the patients were sicker than the private providers could manage, and they go back and forth to the hospital a lot. And so they're fully integrated into the DPH care system as patients. And that revolving door is likely to escalate if you go to private providers, which like have higher turnover, higher vacancy rates, the workers tend to get paid half as much. So the idea that the city somehow is going to provide more services to existing patients for less money, it doesn't make sense. And there's also no staffing plan for what the future service will be at the BHC. So there's going to be renovations. It's not like you approve the PSC, they move the patients, and then the next day the workers get reassigned. There's potentially years of renovations, years of uncertainty of workers moving around, years of them figuring out what the staffing model will be. So yes, there's potentially the ending up with new positions, but it's sort of like saying, well, you know, SF General Hospital has a labor and delivery unit, and we've decided to close the labor and delivery unit and expand the ICU, and all those labor and delivery nurses are now ICU nurses, but there's not a loss of jobs, even though it's a completely different thing. It's the exact same type of exercise, and it's a dangerous road to go down. If you prove it, this PSC is definitely going to result in continued litigation in front of PERB, as the union has, you know, beat the city in these PERB cases 10 times in the last decade over the abuse of these types of provisions and the city's assertion of its rights. So we ask that this issue get tabled until the supervisors can act and the process can be exhausted, and there can be a plan that allows the patients to move with the workers who have been caring for them for decades, which is what all of them want. Thank you.
Could you please expand on your comment about the supervisors? That's number one. Number two, could you expand on the staff, that the fact that the department's been presenting it as an increase in staff? But I particularly would like to hear a little bit more about what you're saying as far as the supervisors are going to be action and supervisors.
Sure. So thank you. So in there was a proposal in 2019 to close the ARF and relocate it and move a private provider in, and the Board of Supervisors passed legislation in 2019 to preserve the adult rehabilitation facility at the BHC location. operated by city providers. So these, the people behind me on the city side know that in order to move forward with this plan, the Board of Supervisors actually has to act to amend the 2019 ARF legislation and negotiate with the union about the impacts of that before any of this can be implemented, and none of that has occurred yet. And potentially, if the supervisors may or may not do that, if they don't, then the whole conversation changes. Just on the other point, it's that the work is changing. So the department is relocating the existing functions at the BHC to a new location. They don't need, they're not, there's no requirement that they be privatized at the new location. No, that's not a stipulation of the state funding that's being used to renovate the BHC. There's no regulatory requirement. There's no impediment to the city saying we want to move the workers and the patients. And then if we want to add another service at the old BHC location after the move for a locked substance use program, they can certainly do that. That can be its own conversation. But it's still taking an existing patient care service, even if there's 7,000 FTEs or something across the Department of Public Health, and they move around all the time. We just in the last budget process, there was an announcement that there might be layoffs. We received a notice from the city saying, here's 25 positions within DPH that are going to be subject to layoff, but those people won't lose their jobs because we have vacancies that those people can relocate into. That they're sort of saying the same thing here. Well, we're eliminating these positions. Those people will have other jobs in the same classification that they can relocate into, but the thing that you were doing now is going away. And the from the union's perspective, the elimination of existing bargaining unit work, care for the patients at the ARF, at the BHC, that, you know, we have, there are lots of classifications that cut across a lot of different city functions, right, within DPH. Lots of different types of care, lots of different modalities. Work gets changed all the time based on evolving evidence and clinical needs. That's a normal feature of the healthcare system. They say, oh, we have a new treatment, we have a new medication, we have a new protocol we want to introduce, and then people get trained on it, and they do that thing. There's no reason that the work can't follow the patients as planned, except that they decided ahead of time that they didn't want to do it, and because they saw some other private provider. I don't know, you'll have to ask them why, but the city has yet to present a reason why permanent ongoing work that has been city work for decades should stop being city work just because they decided to move it from one building to another building.
I have some comments, but if you have further questions,
please. This is a little bit off topic. I'm curious as to why you did not opt to use the new bargain process for this contract.
We requested it and it was denied. So that is the PSC notification as of today. I received a letter earlier today from Jonathan Wright. We requested to use the new fact-finding review process, but because that took effect July 1 and we received the initial notification about this PSC on May 23rd, they're saying it fell before. The union believes that under the provision of the contract, we have the right to submit this issue to binding arbitration, and we will assert that right, and so it's also going to be subject to arbitration, and whatever process follows that. We believe that we have a right to meet with the mayor under paragraph 95 of this contract, and we are going to assert a right to do that. And we will also seek any other remedies and recourse that we could find.
Okay, thank you. I have a question for the department. The backup documents do indicate that this has to go to the Board of Supervisors. And so I'm just wondering what that process is. It submitted to the board as a contract for approval?
No, the legislation would be, I don't know if it's an ordinance or a resolution, I think a resolution to the Board of Supervisors. So in 2019, the Board of Supervisors passed, it's an ordinance, let me look at my notes, 29519, which requires DPH to operate a licensed adult residential facility with no fewer than 41 beds on the first floor of the BHC. This requirement remains in effect, and this PCS request does not override it. What the PCS request does is expand licensed boarding care beds at the Hayes Valley facilities and strengthen our locked subacute services at the BHC. These are separate legal and operational issues. The PSC is about immediate expansion. The ARF ordinance will remain in effect unless and until the Board of Supervisors amends it. The commission's action today is not dependent on any future legislation. Again, the PCS request before you is about the Hayes Valley boarding care facilities. We plan to operate those boarding care facilities, which we purchased, as contracted programs if this PCS is granted, regardless of what happens with the ARF legislation related to the BHC. These are parallel tracks, but the responsible path is to act on both fronts. Allow us to expand the boarding care authority today, and separately, let the board debate about the ARF question. One does not depend on the other.
Concerns I have is with regard to whether or not our obligations employ, whether or not within our obligations within the meet and confer, if it's meet and confer, do we have our labor relations specialist here?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Jonathan Wright, Assistant Employee Relations Director. Yes, we've met with
Department of Human Resources.
Department of Human Resources, that's right. We have met with SEIU regarding this proposed personal services contract twice, and we believe that there's no further discussion that would warrant or that would result in a different opinion from either side. Therefore,
the city obligations were met.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
My concerns here are I share some of the concerns of SEIU regarding the FTEs currently employed at BHC and what would happen during the transition. But my bigger concern, I feel the specter of Laguna Honda. I'm a little concerned about the past experience where we had a program in place that served its existing population very well. There was a change in focus and in patient population, which became part of a cascading series of events that really did a lot of damage to what had been a very good program. And so I'm very concerned about what happens to the current population, who some of whom have been there for decades at the BHC, and what the quality assurance will be that we don't see something like what happened in Laguna Honda happen again. That combined with the union's issues related to this PSC, and what I felt was a really positive example of the PSC we approved a couple of meetings ago regarding security at the city's hospitals, where even though it took a long time, the department and the labor partners were able to come to a common position over an extended series of hardworking discussions. My inclination right now would be to give this more time, to give more time for both sides to work together to see if it is possible, even though they seem far apart now, to come to a common position and to perhaps fine-tune the proposal so that it might include some stronger quality assurance language. This is important work that needs to be done, but at the same time, we're talking about 90 to 100 new beds for a potential population of thousands in need. Every little step forward is important, but I don't see the impact as being great enough that we couldn't spend a little bit more time maybe perfecting this proposal. That's where I'm sitting now, given what I've heard from both sides. And if either side wants to comment on that.
And just as a note, our next meeting is on the 16th of September.
I'd actually like to hear the department's reaction to Commissioner Wood's comments.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Angelica Almeida. I'm the Chief Integrative Officer at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital.
So absolutely appreciate that this is a huge change for the residents on the first and second floors of the Behavioral Health Center. So we've been working with them very closely for a number of months now with regular check-ins. I'm going monthly to meet with all the residents. We have community meetings to discuss their concerns as a community, what options there are, answering their questions, giving pictures of different locations, showing them questions and answers, and to be able to make sure that there's clear communication with the residents directly, as well as providing updates to their community providers and to family members so that it's a holistic conversation. The team at the Behavioral Health Center has also met with all of the residents individually for a number of reasons to talk about the significant change, what their preferences are in terms of locations and options. And this has ranged from some people looking at this as an opportunity to have a fresh start and move out of county, some people wanting to move to locations that have more specialized options to meet their cultural needs or, and language preferences, some people wanting to move as a group or to move with their existing roommate. And so we've taken all of those things into account as we're looking at options for individuals, including the new location at 624 and 601 Laguna. So we've started with meeting with the residential care facility for the elderly patients because we anticipate that those are the residents who will be moving first in conjunction with the opening of 624 Laguna to be able to start construction at the Behavioral Health Center. We're continuing with those meetings with residents monthly and individual meetings as needed and meeting with families. I've had a number of conversations with families and residents myself. In terms of making sure that people continue to receive quality care, we're tracking this very closely. As individuals are moving, we're making sure that we're working with their community providers to ensure that there's no deterioration of the individual, that they're stable at their new placement. And of course, our residential system of care within the Department of Public Health has regular meetings with providers to assess the needs, and this will continue to be a focus of that to ensure that people remain stable within their placements, and they ensure the quality of the services provided across all contracted agencies. Of course, Angelica Almeida, it's A-L-M-E-I-D-A. Thank you.
And your comments about Commissioner Wood's suggestion that we take more time to work with your union partners to look at the continuum of services, but also the specific proposal.
So we, of course, are happy to continue in a good faith process with the union and appreciate the opportunity to do that. And if there's additional questions that commissioners have for us to answer in a September meeting, we're also happy to do that. I know that Ms. Kirkpatrick mentioned this, but I also want to highlight how critical this service is from a hospital perspective. Again, when we don't have enough capacity within residential care facilities, as well as mental health rehabilitation centers, people get stuck on inpatient and acute units, which is a higher level of care than they need, which means that individuals who need those beds are stuck in our emergency departments and psychiatric emergency services, which of course means that people in the community who need hospital services are not able to access the specialized care that we have. Just as an example, this is looking from a year of data, but when we looked at the top 25% of individuals waiting for different placements, or what we call lower level of care beds from inpatient psychiatry, 3,000 bed days were people waiting for mental health rehabilitation center beds, and 1,000 were waiting for residential care facilities, both for adults and for the elderly. So roughly 4,000 bed days were used by people who did not need that level of care, which meant that other people weren't able to access the acute services that are needed. And certainly we all see that in the community.
So this is a 36-month contract, which is relatively short given the nature of the services being provided. What is your projected timeline if this PSC is approved?
I am not the best person to answer that, but I'm looking to my team.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can you clarify what you mean a little bit more so I can better answer your question?
Typically, there is a proposed timeline.
Correct.
And so once this commission takes action under the PSC policy, you have to have acted on the contract within 18 months. And so I'm trying to get a sense about when do you expect to start moving people?
Understood.
Realigning staff, and I'm going to use that word, trying to avoid replacing so forth.
I appreciate
So what is the timeline here, and why is this only 36 months?
We were trying to strike the right balance in terms of duration of the request, along with our other services. Uh-huh. I will say, in terms of the BHC and Hayes Valley projects, we are working, we have provisions that have been granted by the mayor and the Board of Supervisors to expedite contracting for behavioral health beds and under the fentanyl crisis. So we could expeditiously enter into contract in the coming months. We know clients would move from the second, we would do a phased approach. No clients would move from the second floor of the BHC, which is currently our RCFE, no sooner than this fall and potentially into this winter. The construction will happen in a phased approach. It'll take 18 to 24 months. It wouldn't begin for, midway through potentially 2026 to allow for planning and design, which will allow for adequate conversations and further conversations in good faith with our labor partners about reassignments and the like. And so we are working to act quickly to get the Hayes Valley facilities up and operating under provisions that will allow us to contract quickly, and working to have time to work with our labor partners on the reassignment during the construction period for the BHC.
It sounds to me like you're going to be coming back. By before the 36 months. For a time duration. I'm not seeing how you're going to be able to accomplish all of that in 36 months.
We may come back at the end of the 36 months for the second portion of the RCFE, but there are 210 other beds that are part of this PSC for our existing beds that would happen immediately. And then we would turn on at least 624 Laguna, which is our RCFE, in the next couple of months. And so potentially for the second building, which would have a longer runway to opening based on the construction at the BHC, we would potentially be coming back sooner. Apologies, I'm not as well versed in the PSC timing and process. So I'm sorry for my kind of tiptoeing around or not answering your question as best as I could.
No, it's not a problem. It's not a problem at all. It was a comment. I don't see how you're going to be able to do this in 36 months, period. I just don't see it. So I'm saying we're going to be revisiting this issue sooner than later. I'm wondering, though, that with regard to the time frame, if we have this presented again, continue some discussion for another month. Is that going to be how is that going to affect you? I didn't get a direct answer, quite frankly, response.
I think we do have a little bit of runway on our existing 210 beds that a month could afford. Any delaying conversations about the PSC as relates to the additional 100 beds would push out the timeline for our ability to contract and then be able to move clients. So every month adds on additional time towards implementing our proposal.
Thank you so very much. Any further questions?
No.
Any further comments?
I want to let the members get a chance to weigh in, but critically, I think you're correct. This is not a 36-month contract. This is a permanent contract. This is not a service that ends. This is taking on a new permanent function. So that's the time horizon here. And the paragraph 112 of the union contract says contracting out should be used sparingly as an option of last resort. And there's a set of criteria, temporary, short-term, unanticipated, emergency situations, situations where there's a conflict of interest. None of that applies here. So the circumstances under which the city decided to contract out the work and moved forward with that plan first without seriously exploring any other options, and it's permanent work. If it would be a different conversation if it was only a temporary contract to manage a transitional phase, but that's not the case here. And because this is a public health matter, that are, and these are long-term patients who are vulnerable, our members have the concern that that you know, as Commissioner Wood was saying, you make decisions about contracting out in the heat of the moment, and then when patients have bad outcomes, none of us are the ones who have to deal with the consequences of that. That happens down the line, and the union is accused, and our members are accused of being, you know, alarmist or whatever. But there are, you know, there are real world human impacts of rushing these decisions and not being rigorous about making sure that we're maintaining the highest standard of patient care possible, and taking an existing stable successful program and disrupting it just because you're moving buildings is not a good justification for that. Thanks.
Commissioner Wood.
I'm ready to make a motion if you.
I'm fine with Commissioner Wood making the motion. I actually would also like to, I know the process is that public comment after the motion, but I am actually curious to hear from the members.
So we'll do that first.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No problem.
How many are, do we have? Should we do 2 minutes apiece? 2 minutes?
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Sarah Clark. I've been a registered nurse at the BHC for 8 years. I am perplexed as to why the city is trying to dismantle the ARF and the RCFE rather than taking credit for its success. According to available evidence, life expectancy in patients with chronic and severe mental illness is shorter than in the general population by 10 to 20 years, with a weighted average life expectancy of 64.7 years. That loss of 10 to 20 years is attributed largely to preventable natural causes. The average age of an RCFE resident is 71 years old, and we have 5 who are in their 80s. It is undeniable that the staff of the Board and CARES play a huge role in our residents beating the odds. I have seen urinary tract infections, respiratory illnesses, heart disease, cancer, and more be caught early because our staff have been with the residents for so long and know them well enough that they are able to notice subtle changes that indicate something is amiss. The residents also trust our staff enough to tell them when something is wrong, which is a huge accomplishment for both residents and staff. In addition to individual outcomes, ARF and RCFE have a positive systemic impact. We all know that preventative healthcare is more cost-effective than emergency medicine. Many of the residents of both Board and CARES cycled through emergency medical and psychiatric services before achieving stability at the BHC. There is no evidence to suggest that this stability is replicable in a private Board and CARES, and in fact, there is evidence to the contrary, given that many of our residents came to us after private Board and CARES did not work out for them. It is short-sighted to try and save money by privatizing the care these residents currently receive. I do not object to the assertion that San Francisco needs more locked subacute beds. I do object to privatizing care that has been successfully provided by city workers for decades and that no one argues is not working. I also have a petition from the Board and CARES residents asking not to be relocated. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. This person.
Good afternoon, board. My name is Alphonse LaRocca. I am a resident member of RCFE Behavioral Health, and I don't think we should be changing something that works. And I think I went to the wrong thing. I came for the rally, but I got this. So that's somebody working in my life. And new contracting and all that kind of thing. I'm very don't know, I'm bipolar. I'm upset about this. But I said I'm going to fight. You know, I don't want to move. And I'm taking steps to take care of my move. I mean, I understand that nobody's going to get put out in the street. But we're nervous, you know. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much. Next person.
Commissioners, you don't know me. I'm the head of the Ombudsman Program in San Francisco, and under federal law, we have jurisdiction over all the RCFEs in the city and all the skilled nursing facilities. Can you hear me?
Could you state your name?
My name is Benson Nadel. Thank you. And as such, I have 30 years of experience in San Francisco looking at the trends. Most recently, we've been involved with Laguna Honda, and it's almost closing, and some of the individuals there. We also commented on the JAL report, and that is featured in God's Hotel book. But let me express some of my concerns with the privatization of the behavioral health system in general and specifically. I totally agree that quality assurance is the key factor in making sure individuals who transition to the Laguna Street facilities or even some of the smaller boarding care homes have sufficient oversight to ensure that quality. What has not been mentioned in this presentation is all the case management services that enhance therapeutic services within the BHC and the smaller boarding care homes. What has not been mentioned is the fact that the smaller boarding care homes have house doctors who totally ignore the physical ailments as they emerge from the behavioral health clients. I had a client at a boarding care home that was pretty substandard, although subsidized by the city, that had a person develop Parkinson's symptoms. They said it was tardive dyskinesia. He fell down, and he died. I went into the closed folder for that individual from a acute care hospital. He actually had Parkinson's, no medications. They thought it was tardive dyskinesia. That's the kind of situation I'm about to run into in terms of the poor quality in some of the smaller RCFEs. I think that if the city wants to transfer individuals to private RCFEs, particularly the smaller ones, there has to be greater attention to quality assurance. And in the contract, build in additional oversight. Community care licensing is inadequate in providing oversight. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Next person.
Hello, my name is Darren Page, and I've worked at the RCFE in its current form since it opened, and I've worked at the Behavioral Health Center for over 28 years. So my major concern is outcomes for residents if they're moved. The staff that work at the RCFE right now, we have drivers to assist them to get to appointments. We have escorts to help them navigate the appointments, which building to go to, which office to go to, how to navigate the system, things that I don't believe that they would be able to do on their own. We've had residents who have been caught early with prostate cancer, breast cancer, all because we have about a 90% success rate in getting people to go to their appointments and complete them. And I'm concerned that Pride and Board and Cares would not provide the services that we do. There is a sort of in between of a regular board and care and say a SNF, and we're kind of like that. People who can't be totally 100% independent, but they're not quite ready for more, you know, like say a SNF or something like that. And, you know, we have residents on our floor who have been there for more than 10 years, 7 years, more than 5 years. And this kind of stability is really unheard of. You know, and our residents get to live the lives that the mental health system is set up for them to live. They're independent as much as possible. They have a community of people around them. They're co-residents that they have relationships with. And because they've been there so long, the staff have relationships with them. And I believe these things are absolutely really important for their stability and them being able to live good, fulfilling lives. And, you know, the other concern I have is that if the whole building is converted into subacute, I know from working in the building that the third floor subacute has been half empty for 2 to 3 years Where are all these residents going to come from to fill up a whole two more floors? I'm concerned about the exact planning and hurting other people that already live there in order to fill it up with people who don't even really exist.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This person?
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Elizabeth Travelslight. I'm a field representative at SEIU Local 1021. I represent our members at the Behavioral Health Center. For a variety of scheduling reasons, we have several family members, staff, and residents of the ARF and the RCFE who regret being unable to come and speak with you today. I will say that they have spoken repeatedly and publicly in opposition to the privatization of the ARF and the RCFE services. They have addressed the San Francisco Health Commission and city supervisors. They have spoken at public rallies and to the press. Our primary concern with DPH's plan is the very serious health risks to the BHC's uniquely vulnerable client population posed specifically by the privatization of their care. The union has met and conferred twice with city representatives to discuss an alternative that maintains quality and continuity of care and avoids flagrant violations of our CBAs, city legislation, and California labor law. Yet DPH continues to insist on the privatization of a successful essential service as a matter of political convenience. I don't see it any other way. And with shocking disregard for the lives at stake. We have made it clear that the union will not oppose the portions of the contract unrelated to the current services provided by public employees at the BHC, nor will we oppose the voluntary relocation of clients to DPH properties at 601 and 624 Laguna Street. Many ARF and RCFE residents have cycled dangerously in and out of private board and care. This is a fact. Emergency medical and psychiatric services and homelessness. Their current health and hard-won stability are an inarguable result of the quality and durability of dedicated civil service care providers. No private provider of these services will be able to reproduce the kind of safe, supportive, consistent living conditions that ensure the continued well-being of these residents.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Esteen. I'm a registered nurse with the city of San Francisco for 15 years. I currently work for the residential system of care, which helps to place people in and out of our locked facilities and our boarding care homes. I know intimately the details of which everyone has been speaking. And I would say that we need more boarding care homes. We need more beds. What this actually would create is a zero net gain. There is no bed capacity that is increased on the boarding care level by closing this facility and moving people to the Laguna site. Additionally, the 624 Laguna site does not offer dementia care. The contract that is being proposed specifically states it will offer dementia care that is not currently being offered at the BHC. However, the site that will offer care is 601, which the city is not currently ready to open. As we heard, there is no timeline for 601 even being opened. Our BHC is staffed with licensed providers. You asked about care, quality of care. You've heard the stories. Our residents live longer. They have better quality of life. We have steady civil service staff who are licensed. Boarding care homes in the community do not have licensed staff at all. They don't need it. It's part of the cost savings that will diminish care that is provided to residents. And as we also have heard, our BHC offers a higher standard of care, which is very beneficial to our residents. Also, to say these are parallel facts is to blur the lines. That is not true. The third floor, let's move on to what is currently locked. Our MRC is not at capacity. It is not fully staffed, it is not fully occupied, and it has not been for a number of years. So when we talk about 3,000 bed hours for locked, waiting for a locked placement, we should try to fill the beds at the MRC now instead of opening something new. Also, we do need locked beds, but we should open them somewhere else In 2024, the city had an opportunity to have a contract at St. Francis for an open vacant site and let that go. There are other options in the community.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we should hear from the department before we do a motion.
Department, would you like to respond?
I had my notes, but I brought my wrong notebook. Lana Kim, head of HR. So we have, thank you very much for hearing our presentation and for the for SEIU and others to come. I've taken notes in order to be able to provide responses to the questions that have been raised and the issues that have been the questions that have been asked and the issues that have been raised. We're happy to kind of come back and provide those responses. I know in addition, Commissioner Wood, I think you had questions around FTE, how we're going to do the staffing. I'm happy to answer a bit of that now or just wait till the presentation and provide you some more details regarding the staffing and the adjustments that are going to be made. Just wait for a cue from you as to whether you'd like me to start talking about that.
Well, as of now, until there's a motion made, this is pretty much it for the PS. So if you do have something to present now, this would probably be the time to do it on the FTEs.
I see. Let me just grab my notes. Well, let me just talk very generally. So there was some reference to the DPH budget as it related to vacancies.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Excuse me. I'm just wondering, is the department open, you know, before a motion, is the department open to the idea of holding this off until September 15th, our next Civil Service Commission meeting, and providing more extensive data that you have more time to prepare?
Yes, we are open to that.
Oh. Okay, and to have further discussion with the employee organizations.
Yeah. Yes, we are open to that.
Okay, so let's go with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with that, I'll make a motion that we table this PSC last numbers 5440 to our next scheduled Civil Service Committee meeting, which will be September 15th. I think it's
15th.
15th, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No problem. With the hopes that the department and their labor partners might be able to come closer, if not exactly to the same position on the issues involved, and provide a little bit more information related to what the transition would be for FTEs and also perhaps quality assurance for the current residents of the BHC.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
And I will second that motion, and also want to thank the department, SEIU, employees and members of SEIU for coming forward. It's been a very important discussion. We all know that the population we're talking about needs our support, needs more services and the depth of services. So I look forward to hearing more at our meeting on the 15th. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And did I second?
Yes. Okay. That's a second right there. So we've had a motion and a second. Any additional public comment? If you're in the room, please come to the book. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
Hi, I'm just here as the spouse, but I'm an architect and a psychotherapist, and I listen to some of these proposals. Well, my name is Vivek Anand. Vivek Anand, resident of San Francisco. I heard it said that we only operate, as DPH only operates services for seniors in hospitals. And that was just sort of presented as a fact that cannot be challenged. And no one questioned that. So I just thought I'd raise it, that if the DPH is open to running facilities outside hospitals, then they'd be open to running Laguna. If they are not open to it, we need to know why.
Thank you. Is there any other further comment? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, so I'll do a roll call vote. Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye. Vote is 3-0 to postpone this
for further discussion with the employee organizations and department, and hopefully to come to agreement at our next meeting on the 15th of September, 2025. And thank you to everyone. It's been a very good presentation and appreciate your comments and time. Shall we go to the next item?
We are now on the consent agenda. All matters on the consent agenda considered by the Civil Service Commission will be acted upon by a single vote of the commission. There will be no separate discussion on these items unless a request is made, in which event the matter shall be removed from the consent agenda and considered as a separate item. I will need to read all categories we have. Item 8, annual report on certification of eligibles, entry and promotion, uniform ranks of fire, police, and sheriff. Recommendation of the Human Resource Director, adopt the report. Item 9, report on position-based testing. Recommendation of the Human Resources Director, adopt the report. Item 10, report of future employment restrictions and probationary releases for the period of July 1, 2024. To June 30, 2025, recommendation of the Human Resources Director, adopt the report. Item 11, survey of monthly rates paid to police officers and firefighters in all cities of $350,000 or more in the state of California. Recommendation of the Human Resources Director, adopt the report. Transmit rates to the retirement system in accordance with Charter Section A8.590.1 through A8.590.7, provide report to the Board of Supervisors. Item 12, report on provisional appointments. Recommendation of the Human Resources Director, adopt the report. And item 13, appeal by Shalise Otis of the Human Resources Director's determination to administratively close Otis's complaint of retaliation and race harassment. This one is being postponed at the request of the appellant to the meeting of September 15th.
Okay, all items within the consent agenda are here for motion except for items number 8 and item number 10, which have been severed for further for questions. So if we could have a motion on the remaining portions of the consent agenda, that would be item number 9, item number 11, 12, and 13.
Yeah. I move that we approve the consent agenda. Absent agenda items 8 and 10 that have been pulled for further discussion.
Second.
Okay, do we have any public comment on the motion? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
For the roll call vote, Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye. It's 3-0 to approve the remaining portion of the, or the most of the consent agenda, except for items number 8 and 10. So here we are on item number 10, or 8. And I have a very simple question, but, you know, I couldn't ask it and was, anyway. But it's an excellent report. But I did want to have some clarification on this. It's on page 5. It has to do with conducting the validation study that determined candidates who possess a ballot drug could be exempted from written examinations. Could you, I was noticing that, can you expand a little bit on that? I just, the idea that somebody would be exempted from an examination because they have a degree, I don't quite get the nexus.
So at the, Jen Lowe, Public Safety Team Manager, in regards to that request, it was the SFPD that had asked to have the written test waived for those who had a bachelor's degree. So right now, there are two forms of the written test, National Testing Network, and then the Pellet B, which is a post-entry-level law enforcement test battery that the California Post administers. That is both pass-fail. And so Dave Johnson did a validation study of all candidates that had a bachelor's degree and took the test previously against those who candidates that just took the test and did not have a degree. And so he did find a correlation that there is a success rate of those who took the test. So right now, if you have a bachelor's degree, you are waived from taking the written test.
For further clarity, we basically looked at the what we're testing, what's being tested in the written tests, and compared it to someone who would have a degree. former assistant director Dave Johnson validated it with that study. It is not the only exam component. It's just the first component, which is pass fail. And then they go into a physical ability test and an oral exam. So it's a pass fail exam. It's
I just find it very, very interesting. I would not assume having a degree would necessarily make a person able to pass that test better. It's curious, that's all.
Yes, it's the knowledge, skills, and abilities tied to the test, and which is gained through possession of a bachelor's degree.
Okay, I'm just surprised at that. That did actually correlate. Anyway, so thank you very, very much. And so I would move to approve this report. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
You have a second.
Mm-hmm.
And do we have any public comment on the motion? If you're in the room, come to the podium. If you're on the phone, press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
A roll call vote. Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye. The vote is 3-0 to adopt the report. And thank you very much for your work. Okay, so we'll go on to item number 10. I think there's more than one person here that has questions on this. It's a report of future employment restrictions and probationary releases for the period of July 1, 24 to June 30, 25. And then the recommendation is to adopt the report. So here we are. Thank you so very much. So.
Yeah.
Vice President Minor?
I did. I pulled it. I wondered if you had any. Well, first of all, thank you for being here. And as usual, thank you for the excellent work.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Sean Sherburn with the Department of Human Resources, Assistant Director, Employment Services. I'm joined by my colleague, Gianno Bitu, who is the Client Services Manager. He's actually the author of the report. I just came back from a fabulous vacation, so I will not take the credit for it, even though my name is on there. This is a report that we produce on a regular cycle for the commission. Years past, the commission asked that we add in addition to future employment restrictions, which is what is included in the annual report, additional information on probation releases. Mm-hmm. So we've included that. We further adapted that a couple of years ago at the commission's request to add in classifications for probation releases. And so my colleague Gianno and I would be happy to discuss any trends, questions you may have. And we've also had some of our department partners here as well, if there are questions specifically about departmental actions.
Okay, very good. I think I can ask a pretty specific question. Looking at attachment B on the current report, job code 2905, the HSA eligibility worker. I went back and looked at least 1 year's previous report, and this is trending up in terms of the number of probe releases. Mm-hmm. And we have had some public comment doing commission meetings about the number of probe releases. And so I'm wondering if you can, if I don't know if someone from the department is here, or if you'd like to try to help us to understand what's going on. I see someone from the department is here. Okay.
Because we actually have a representative from the department who explained why the high relate mm-hmm. rate, and yet it's not gone down.
Right.
So there's been a significant discussion on this class. So thank you so very much for being here.
Good afternoon, commissioners.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present. My name is Katrina Williams, and I'm the HR director for San Francisco Human Services Agency. As it relates to our 2905 senior eligibility worker, there has been an increase in the probationary releases, but there's also been an increase in our hiring. We started, I want to say, 3 years ago at the beginning of my tenure with a 16% vacancy rate. We were able to get that vacancy rate down to below 10%.
In that particular class?
Across the board, but in that particular class, we really hyped up the amount of
the amount of cohorts that we brought in. So in a very short period of time, specifically in this fiscal year, I believe we hired around 200 staff. So this shows actually about an 80% success rate. So the 29 releases, that's roughly 20% of who we hired. So we have an 80% success rate.
Oh, okay. That's good.
The
20% non-success is pretty significant.
Yes, I don't deny that.
Yeah, I mean, very significant.
I don't deny that. One of the challenges that many have come to the civil service with is around our assessments and evaluations. And the reasons why we have assessments and evaluations is because we administer public service programs that have an error rate requirement. And when we reach a certain level in our error rate, we receive financial sanctions. So we must keep the error rate low. So we're training staff to not only understand the eligibility programs, but we also need to ensure that they are able to understand eligibility, authorize eligibility correctly, so that they are not under a higher level of supervision. So when they're in the classroom, they're learning eligibility, they're learning how to determine, they're learning budgets. Then they move into the on-the-job training process where they have a supervisor who assists them, but they are not able to authorize. Once they pass another level of training where they are evaluated for accuracy and timeliness, they are moved on, they pass probation, and they're able to authorize on their own. Even in that space, we still have an error rate in San Francisco of about 12%. Across California, we have an error rate of about 10%. Currently, the federal government will cover 50% of our administrative costs, which we're able to kind of, I don't want to say couch, but we're able to cover our error rate with those costs. With the passing of HR 1, the federal government is only going to cover 25%. And depending on where your error rate is, you're going to have a corrective action plan with the feds, and the state will be required to take on additional percentage of operating costs. So this is going to cost us more if our error rate continues to climb, which is why evaluation is so important. Which is why the testing piece is so important, because we need to ensure that not just our vulnerable San Franciscans are getting the safety net services that they need, but they're being administered properly, excuse me.
Is it any error or particular categories of error?
A lot of them are around overpayment. You mean in the assessments and training?
Mm-hmm.
I have our learning and organizational development manager, Rosa Ortiz, here. And I also have some representatives from our eligibility programs who can speak directly to the assessment pieces and even to the timeliness and accuracy pieces.
Okay. Initially, I was more interested in terms of the fines that are assessed.
Oh, so those are
fees. All errors or particular categories of errors result in the fines and penalties?
So the fines are typically around an error of $57 or more, but that is going to go away with HR 1, and it is zero. Any error will be counted negatively. Yes.
And when is that effective?
That is going to start, I believe, fiscal year 28 is when it starts, but they are going to use our error rates for the previous three fiscal years to determine our starting point.
Mm-hmm. And in view of this change, what changes have been made in the training, the monitoring?
So since the bill was just passed, we haven't had an opportunity to make any additional changes. But at this time, we are not planning to change the passing point, which is currently 70%. We do believe that moving out of classroom and into on-the-job training, that our trainees are able to get the additional support they need for the additional understanding. There was a time when I came before you where our passing point was 80%. Mm-hmm. And we have since taken it down so that we can further support folks on the other side of training, but all of this happens during the probationary period. Once we have a better understanding of how the federal government plans to map out HR1, which will then impact how the state sees HR1, because the state has the opportunity to decide whether or not they split the liability with us or we take on our own financial liability of these errors. So that's going to be another impact because we don't know yet how that's all going to play out.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I had one other question, unfortunately, Doc. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It was regarding the police department, and unfortunately, Director Houston, I see, got out of the room before to ask that question.
You want us to go wrangle him?
Oh, the 44. I just wanted to know if the response could be.
It's possible we can answer some questions pertaining to that. We do have
okay,
some.
So the 44 releases, is that an increase percentage-wise with regard to the rate of hire to our previous years? Is that the same, the different? Are we finding that there's a.
No, it's definitely higher, at least higher than what was reported in the other two.
Jen Lowe, Public Safety Team Manager. I think there has been an increase in hires since last year. So we've, like, just in terms of appointments and overall in the department and separations overall, we are actually net positive this year. In years past, in this report, at least the last few years, the police department has been in the negative.
All right, so it's not getting worse necessarily.
Is it?
I don't think it's gotten worse this year, but we have been we are actually in the positive overall for the police department.
So President Favetti, just one. So I had a sidebar earlier on with Director Williams, and one of the things we talked about, and you're hearing it with police, there's generally across the board a larger number of PCS hires being made, partially directly related back to the programs that this commission supported us on, that we pushed forward with rule updates, more pathways for PCS hires. We've been successful over the last couple of years in doing that, and so the numbers themselves are higher for PCS positions. Corresponding to that, we're reporting raw data on the number of probation releases. And I think comparatively, Giano also had a graph. So it went from generally 3.2 to 3.3% releases. So we are staying about the same in terms of number of probation releases. We're just seeing higher numbers because we are successfully implementing these programs under our recent rule updates for flexible hiring, exempt to permanent. These are good problems to have. We all look at probation period as the final stage in the selection process. I think collectively we've used that term before. You know, do you meet MQs? Did you take an exam? Did you get on an eligible list? Were you hired off of an eligible list through a defensible, valid post-referral selection process? And then the probation period.
Right. So, okay.
In particular for a Q2 police officer, the release from probation is because they didn't pass the academy or field training. So that is the majority of the reason.
And so that would be a non-release. They can always reapply at any time. Okay. So there's not.
Yes.
Okay. That's a good thing. Okay. Good. Thank you.
Can I ask on that just for extra clarification? Does that number include for the Q2s members who are in the academy, released while still in the academy? Okay, got it.
Yeah, right, okay. Mm-hmm. So would you like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion. I move that we adopt the report on future employment restrictions and probe releases for the period July 1, 24 to June 30th, 25.
Second the motion.
Do we have any public comment on the motion? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
Here we go. Hello, Jesse Stanton. I'm a rank and file member of SEIU 10 to 1 and a 2905 eligibility worker with the San Francisco Human Service Agency. This issue of release from probation for 2905s is something, as I've given comment to this commission before. It's a matter of some lengthy discussion and over bargaining with management. I feel like Director Williams' explanation was not sufficient for our purposes. The fact that errors exist, I mean, the financial penalties exist in lots of different areas for incorrect work, and you don't see people flunking out. Qualified candidates, qualified selectees, people who've passed the exam, passed through months of training, and then just released from probation in such large numbers. And it's 29 people being released. If that's 20%, that's almost what's clearly way out, an order of magnitude larger than the citywide release from probation rates. And I feel like it's sort of stepping aside the issue, saying that well, financial penalties exist. There are error rates that are measured, and penalties exist. They're not speaking to the fact that releasing these people from probation is addressing that in any way, or increasing the number of hires and increasing the number of people who are released from probation. It's just churning through qualified people and not giving them a good chance to do their job and to serve the city and county of San Francisco. We feel like it's still a problem. It's a problem in the onboarding process. One of the concerns, I believe, is too many cooks in the kitchen. They've got a big team here. There's three different sets of teams that do this onboarding process. Maybe that's part of it. The director was speaking towards the exam and testing process during onboarding. I think there's definitely some work to improve there, but I don't think the department addressed the core issue here today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Ms. President Pavetti, no public comment at this time.
Oh, thank you. So we have a motion and a second. I'll do the roll call vote. Vice President Minor.
Aye.
Commissioner Wood.
Aye.
And I vote aye. That's 3-0, and we adopt the report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shall we go on to the next item?
Item 14, public comment on all matters pertaining to items 17, including public comment on whether to hold items. Item 17 in closed session. Item 15, vote on whether to hold item 17 in closed session. Item 17, request for a hearing by Jordan Allen Stansel on their future employment restrictions. Recommendation of the Director of Transportation, adopt the reports, deny the appeal, and approve the future employability restrictions.
Okay, so is there any public comment? Item number 14 on whether to hold item number 16 and 17 in closed session, or actually 16,
just 17.
And if you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, so we'll go on to the next item, a vote on to whether to hold item number 17 in closed session. Do we have a motion?
I move that we convene in closed session to hear agenda item 17.
Second the motion.
Okay, and we've already had public comments. So Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye, 3-0. So only those who are concerned with the item number 17, the request for hearing by Jordan Allen Stansel on their future employment restrictions should be present.
Is the appellant here?
Is the appellant here?
Yes, the appellant is here, and I'll be making them a panelist.
Thank you very much to all the.
Oh, so the appellant is online?
Yes, virtually.
Okay.
So thank you to staff, DHR staff. And are these all MTA employees?
President Favetti, before we start, just let me remove us from the recording and stop the recording at this time so that we can enter into closed session. Okay. It is 3:50 p.m.
Oh, thank you. I was gonna...
So hold on just one sec.
Old habits die hard, I'll tell you that. Announcing the time.
President Favetti, the recording is now on. It is 4:37 p.m.
Thank you. We are now on item number 18. We have convened in open session, and now we need to have a motion on a vote to elect whether to disclose any or all discussions on item number 17 in closed session.
I move that we not disclose the discussions related to agenda item 17, but disclose the decision by the commission.
Second.
And any public comment on the motion? If you're in the room, please come to the podium. If you're on the phone, please press star 3 now.
President Favetti, no public comment at this time.
Okay, I take a roll call vote. Vice President Minor?
Aye.
Commissioner Wood?
Aye.
And I vote aye. We will not be just revealing any of the discussions, but we will be indicating the vote. And the vote was 3-0 on the request for hearing by Jordan Allen Stancil on their future employment restrictions to indicate 5 years outside satisfactory service before returning to the city and county of San Francisco for any position other than driving, and 10 years outside service for any position that would require driving. Okay. And so we are on to our next item.
Item 19, commissioners' announcements or requests.
Well, we need to follow up on the Commissioner Salveson luncheon. Publicly noted.
Publicly announced lunch. Yeah.
I don't know if she's back from
traveling.
I think coordinating vacation schedules is probably going to be the hardest thing. I don't know if that's an official request, but I would imagine we should follow up on celebrating her final term with the City of Civil Service Commission, or not the final necessarily.
And just a follow up. Twice now, I've asked about an update from EEO on where we are with timelines for completion, workflow, number of pending cases, and so forth. And I know everyone is extremely busy. And so I think it would be helpful if we could just agree to when they will be, they don't have to have it ready now, but certainly agree when they can put it on the calendar before the end of this calendar year, please. Thank you.
With perhaps a focus in second meeting in October.
Mm-hmm. Because you'll be back, right?
Oh, yeah.
You'll be back.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other requests? So we're on the final item.
Item 20 is adjournment. It is now 4:40 p.m.
There we go.
All right.